Three, two, one, and we're back. Okay, so in this podcast, we're actually going to revisit an old topic, but at the same time, I'm going to be talking about something that I feel like I didn't explain that well the first time around, because when I was doing this podcast, I was actually rigging an eel. So in this podcast, we're going to go over the basics of eeling. And the reason I wanted to go over the basics of eeling is because I've had a lot of questions from people because I didn't do a great job of explaining how to eel that well. But before we get into that, I want to go over some stuff from last week that I was talking about. And so let's get into that first. Okay, so first things first, the other week, or actually 2 weeks ago now, I switched out the hooks on my Magnum Walker for inline singles, so these are VMC inline single hooks, size 7-0 VMC inline single hooks. Hopefully you can see that on the camera. So I tested this out today. Because the other week the water was actually frozen in the inner harbor, so I couldn't fish. I couldn't throw these plugs to test. So luckily it's actually starting to get much warmer out, and it's going to be in the 60s all this next week, and it was in the 50s, which is a super awesome sign that the fishing is going to start up soon. We are getting into the we're getting into mid-March now. Not really, but kind of. So it's closer to mid-March than it is the beginning. So we're going to call it, we're getting closer to mid-March. And so that means striped bass migration is going to really start hard now. I've heard a lot of good things about the bass starting to move in to spawn. And so, or at least not moving into spawn yet, but starting to get more active. And so that's good. And I'm excited for the next few weeks. I think it's going to really start getting really awesome. As far as like the fish are going to start to move. And so I was using this plug. And the cool thing is, I think it works. So I think that it's a little bit trickier to use these inline circles because I think that it throws off the action a little bit. Now, the thing is, throwing off the action a little bit is not too bad. I mean, the action is thrown off where I think it just takes a little bit more skill now to work the plug correctly. I was also throwing it, and it was low tide, and I was up on a retaining wall, so I was probably 10 feet above the water. And when I was out further, I could really get a good walking motion with it. But when it got in closer, the walking motion was a little bit more difficult. But so I think maybe the size down will be a little bit better. So I'd go with size 6 to size 5, I think might be a little bit better. I think size 5 will be a little small. So I'd go like size 6 if you're planning on doing this. Although I am going to keep this rigged like this, and because I do think that I want these bigger hooks on it, because I do think if I hook into a larger fish, this will just be healthier for it, and it will also stay pinned a lot better. So that's that. And then the other thing that I was trying out is the small Magnum Walker. So the small Magnum Walker, I mean, as you can see, it's a fair bit smaller than the big one. But oh my God, is the small one incredible. I am so, so excited to be throwing this spring. I think it's the perfect size to really get some, you know, bass, some schoolies up to, I mean, you can get up to 40 pound bass on this in the back bays. I mean, this is the perfect size. I think it's like 6 inches, and don't quote me on that. And, so it's really like a nice size and profile of like a medium sized bait fish to smaller bait fish. So I think that this is like our missing key. I mean, you have the small plugs out there, the smaller walking plugs, but you don't see a lot of nice wooden smaller spooks. And this thing absolutely zigzags and tears up the surface. So I'm super, super excited for this in the spring. But let's get into eeling. The thing about eeling is I've talked about it, and I also talked about fishing rig deals. But during that podcast, I was concentrating on rigging the eel and not on... Well, I was concentrating on rigging the eel and less on really explaining a lot about the gear and the reasons, the smaller reasons of how and why to throw eels and where to throw eels. I talked a little bit about it at the beginning of the podcast. I used a bunch of different rods and reels, but I really want to get into a little bit more in depth and make it a little bit easier for those of us who might be super new to striped bass fishing and don't fully understand the gear and stuff. So it's a little bit easier for them and for really, quite frankly, everyone else to understand what I was talking about in that podcast, because I don't think I did it justice. Anyway, so I'm going to actually start off by talking about line. Now, line and hooks, but because so the first time I made this podcast, this is before the actual regulations, the new regulations came out. So we were fishing. I mean, these are smaller hooks, by the way. I fish with size 8 Gamagatsu hooks normally when I'm fishing for fishing with eels. But this is just a normal Gamagatsu J hook right here. I'm showing this on the video podcast. I think it's probably a size 4, maybe a size 3 Gamagatsu J hook. And I would use the Gamagatsu J hooks in the size 8 when I was fishing before the regulations came out saying that we had to have inline circles. So this is an offset circle hook. I've used these in the past eeling before. I've actually never used a circle hook eeling. So that's going to be new to me. And I wanted to talk about some of the ways that I'm planning on, you know, hooking into the fish and if it's going to change anything. Because I've had that question come up a lot. What do you think about the new regulations? And also, what are you going to do eeling or and so on and so forth? So this being a, it's actually an offset circle, but it is a circle, a Gamagatsu circle hook nonetheless. And so what the plan is, when you are fishing with a circle hook, and I've used offset circles before, and it actually burned me once on an incredible fish, but it wasn't actually my fish, even though it hurt me as bad, because I was actually trying to land the fish. And so what happened was my brother hooked into a fish. It was probably easily a 40 pound bass. It was 48 inches all day, because later that week we caught a 48 incher, same place. And I was landing it, and I actually landed the fish, exact same size mouth, exact same size fish. So whether it could have even been the same fish, who knows, but we were catching a lot of really, really large fish in like mid, early June. And the fishing was so, it was, oh my gosh, it was on fire in like early June. And I was having a lot of really big fish mixed in with a lot of really, really small fish. I was not getting a lot of fish in between, which I guess is showing us how our fishery is kind of very kooky right now, as far as we have a lot of larger fish and then we have a lot of smaller fish. We don't have a lot of bass in between. Even though in the fall I did see a promising number on plugs, I was catching a promising number of like 35 to 40 inch bass. So I was seeing like a lot of medium-sized bass, which felt good to see, but in the beginning part of the season, there's not a lot of medium-sized striped bass. So what happened to me is I was landing this huge fish, and it was really wavy, and I was wearing waders because it was early June, and we were on a cliff that was very steep, and so I was climbing down this cliff, like scaling down it backwards on this cliff, really like balancing on like a really sharp angle, and with huge waves coming in and splashing up and almost washing me in the water. And so what happened was I grabbed the line and the fish was opened its mouth, and I grabbed my boga. I grabbed my boga, and I have the line, and I'm reaching in with my boga to grab the lip of the bass, and a huge wave hit the fish. I reach down to grab it. I miss, and the fish shakes, and the hook slides out, hits me in the side of the hand. So I'm a little bit hooked, not badly though, and the fish slides into the water. Otherwise, if I didn't have the hook kind of in my hand, I would have dove in the water after that fish. But yeah, I was a little bit hooked, so I didn't want to like dive after it and get really badly hooked. But I lost that fish. I lost the fish, not the guy who hooked the fish. I felt really bad because that was by far the biggest fish that he'd ever caught. I touched the fish though, so you can say what it is, if it was a caught fish or not. I did touch the fish. I touched the leader and the fish, so people could say it's a caught fish. I don't really think it's a caught fish unless you like have control over the fish, in my opinion. But so what happened was is we hooked it, but what happened is the bass, if you can picture the head of the bass, if his lips were here at the top of my fingers, it was hooked right here. The hook was sideways, in the mouth of the fish. I don't know how it was kind of like hooked where the angle of the eye of the, hook and the angle of the hook were almost even. It was just under the, skin of the fish. It was barely hooked and the pressure was on right there. So it was really badly hooked. And then when the fish shook, it just, the tension that it had on it was horrible. So that was one of the flaws that I saw immediately in fishing with circles. And is that if the circle hook doesn't get it in the side of the mouth, it's going to have a very difficult time of hooking it anywhere else, whether that be the top or the bottom lip. It has to get into this corner of the mouth for it to really hook in well. Or it has to go through and thread through the top of the lip and out the top, which is tough when you have a really giant, huge fish swallowing an eel. Now, a lot of people talk about hooking into fish and them not you have to feed the eel to the bass. If that's the case, the fish is small, because when in my opinion, I caught probably 6 fish, maybe 7 that were over like 35 pounds, and almost all of them in one hit would swallow the eel all the way to the back of their throats. If you gave them any time, they would swallow the hook immediately. Like, it is instant. As soon as I would feel that tap, and I mean as soon as I would feel the bass eating the eel, which is one hard tap, it's trying to eat the eel, kill the eel. That's the one big first tap. I would hook set immediately. And even then, you get really close to the back of its stomach. So you need it was like instant when I would hook into the fish, and then it would go. And what I'm talking about is that those fish, I caught a handful more that were even bigger than that. And I have to tell you, there's one that got hooked so deep that I had to cut the line. So actually there's two that one of them wasn't my fish, but there's one that swallowed the hook and we cut the line, and that was instant. And I'm talking about the fish is eating an eel that is 20 inches long easily, and it's swallowing all the way down into its stomach in one hit. So when you're hooking into a bass that's over 40 pounds, that's what's going to happen. This past season, I caught hundreds of fish on eels. I went through so many eels, and caught bass of various sizes, ranging from 10 inches to almost 50 inches, and they would swallow the hook, or wouldn't swallow it, but they would eat it so aggressively. I mean, it was extraordinary. I actually did almost no eeling during the day. I've had very bad luck fishing with eels during the day, really, because I've only caught maybe one schoolie during the day on an eel with perfect conditions around a moon, and then that night catching like multiple bass that were in the 20 pounds. So being able to like get those fish to where you can actually have them eating aggressively is, I mean, I don't know. I mean, you throw an eel in front of a bass, it's going to eat it aggressively if it's large. So that's something I really wanted to talk about, is be super, like, I know so many people say, feed the eel, feed the bass the eel. That might work, but what's going to happen is, even if it's a circle hook, it's going to swallow your circle hook. And that is a guarantee. So if it's small, and what happens is you keep pulling out of the fish's mouth, keep pulling out of the fish's mouth, while that might be frustrating, if you don't do it, I would say pause, like you're fishing with a soft plastic and you're fishing with a small fish. Because what will happen is the bass needs to grab it and then eat it twice. But pause for just a mere second before you're actually laying into the fish, because what's going to happen is the eel is going to go from the, what happens is the bass, that initial hit that you feel, that tap on the end of your rod, is the bass sucking that eel into its mouth. So that's what the initial tap is. Maybe the second tap is it swallowing the eel and it sucking more water into its mouth and swallowing the eel. And that's what the second tap is. Now, I had the worst luck with eeling when I first started out. And it was because I didn't give it time and I wasn't necessarily in a spot that had large fish. The thing about eeling is you need to give it time, and you need to give it time at night. Two stories really, make this, get this rule out there. I mean, I've talked a lot about, if it's not a productive spot, don't spend a lot of time fishing it. But, and how do you know, the spot's not on that night? It's really, that's something that I've always talked about, is super, super difficult to distinguish between, a night being just dead off and the bass are just not feeding, to there being it being a good night of fishing where you're going to hook into a large fish. It's just a matter of time. And that's what I think it's super difficult and kind of something that I think comes with time. If you fish and you fish with eels, if you fish in general a lot, you can kind of have a sixth sense that you know that the fish are there. It's just a matter of time. And when I bring people out, because I do like charters for people that very rarely, but I do them for people that I meet. And when I'm fishing with someone in a spot and I know it's going to be good, it just needs time. I'll tell them, I'll be like, this is what's going to happen. You fish with this eel. If a big fish sees it, it's going to eat it. So really, it's a matter of, we know there's a big fish that's going to swim through this spot. It's just a matter of time before that you get that eel in front of the fish. And what happens is, striped bass are stage fish. So what happens is that fish will come into a spot and it will sit and it will wait for bait to come to it. And it generally will wait where there's strong currents. And what I always talk about is with rips. And with boulders, watching where, if a wave breaks on one side of a rock and the water washes around the side of the rock and flushes out the other side, you know that there's going to be a bass waiting where the water is getting flushed out. Because what happens is, if a bait fish gets pushed in by this wave, it's going to get swept out with the current of the wave sucking back out. So I talk a lot about, when you're looking for structure in rocks, you want to look for where that water is getting sucked back out. If you're looking for... if there's a sandbar and you have waves breaking over the sandbar, that rip where the water is getting sucked out, generally there'll be two, or maybe you'll have one super long one. There'll be one in the middle where the water is getting sucked out from both sides. That's mint. And sometimes you'll be able to see that, where the wave's breaking and where it rises up and then where it falls. And that's something that I really want to get much more into, which is fishing for off of a sandy beach and learning way more about current, and way more about rips and sand, and why a rip on the sand, exactly where that is, and not where it is necessarily, but where the bass are going to be sitting within the rips. And it was, to this day, I'm not the greatest at reading water. It always takes me a while to fully understand what direction the water is getting sucked out of an area. I have to really spend a lot of time in it, because I taught myself how to read water, and I'm not very good at it. And the more I meet and talk to fishermen that are extremely experienced and have gone fish for many, many years, the more I talk to them and learn exactly what different waves and what different like current means and different tides mean for the bass to be staging, that has helped me so much more. And it's something that just every day that I'm spending online reading down, like how to fish on a sandy beach, and just that's something that I need to get way better at, because I think that I'm fortunate to live in a spot that has pretty much every single like scenario for a striped bass. I'm talking about like for a surf fisherman, we have sandy beaches, we have rocks, we have estuaries. I mean, we've everything when it comes to like structure that you can target from shore, where I live. So I know all of those spots produce trophy bass, and I've only figured out one of them, and I haven't even figured that out like fishing that one that well. So I still have years to go with that. But as far as trying to figure out structure where the bass are going to be set up, that's going to be very important when you're talking about, I'm going to place my eel up current. This eel is going to swim down. Granted, if it's a bigger eel, it will swim down faster. So you can keep all of this in mind. If it's a smaller eel, it's going to be swept across the surface. But there's been times where I'll have my eel, I'll cast it out, and it'll be pretty dead, and it will be sweeping across the surface, and the bass will just smash it right on the surface. And they weren't hitting it when it was down in the strike zone. But the soon is because they might have been looking up, because there's probably a little bunker or something on the surface, and the bass is looking up, and then it sees this eel just like slithering right across the surface, and it just comes up and smashes it on the surface like a topwater plug. And that's like so awesome to see. I have one story where I was fishing, and with a rigged eel, and I hooked into a bass. I was fighting it. It was probably a high 20-pound bass. The thing spits it halfway out through the fight, and then I'm reeling in, and I'm ripping it in across the surface, and another like 20-pound bass smashes it on the surface of the water. And that was just full gong show of fishing right there. I mean, like, it was insane to watch those fish be feeding so aggressively, and it just shows you how well that specific thing works. Eeling works so well. I've thrown plugs in spots, and you'll get nothing, and then you throw eels there, and it is lights out. Like, the fishing is insane. So being able to get to where the fishing is insane takes a lot of effort and a lot of time, and it's like, as I said, the first time I ever hooked into a really, really big fish, I just got so scared and so like interested in how powerful the fish were, and how I just became so hyper focused on chasing that feeling of drag, just like I'm helpless because this fish is stronger than me. And so being able to like so hyper focus in on the bass and how to target those big fish is very difficult to do. Took multiple years of trial and error, but I feel like through trial and error, I found that eeling is in most applications the best way to go when you're fishing for large striped bass. And I have some stories that I want to tell that will really cover every single scenario of fishing for big fish. And I fished this one night with an eel. Before I really get into the gear again, I fished this one night with an eel where I was casting out, and there was huge waves, and it was scary to be where I was. I mean, the waves were coming in. I was getting hit chest deep by these massive just walls of white water from these 10 foot waves, like max 10 foot waves coming in, crashing like far, far out, probably 50 yards in front of me, and rolling 8 feet, 4 feet, 3 feet of just white water on top of white water. I mean, it was insane. And I was casting out in this boulder field with these huge snakes of eels. I mean, they were pythons. They're humongous. They're 2-pound eels, easy. And I'm throwing them out with my giant ODM Jigstar rod, just ripping them out there. And they would smash into the water, and they'd slither down, and then I'd just get pounded by these huge, enormous fish. And you can do that with a plug, but you can't really get into the boulders like that on when the weather is like that with a plug. I mean, it's very difficult to get a plug. Maybe you can get down there with a shad stick. I mean, a shad swimmer. So because what will happen with this plug is I can work it where I bend the eye of the plug, not the lip, the eye, and I can bend the eye up and the plug will go down really deep and I can get it to literally bite right into the rocks and just wobble up over these rocks. And the bass are just sitting right in the rocks and they see this plug just go boom under and hit the rock and then they just whack it. I mean, it's extraordinary when these fish really hit hard. It's when it's really like crazy fast wind, big waves. I mean, the fish get so fired up because it's very difficult for them to actually feed and they need to feed so aggressively when it's like that. But we'll get into line. So I did a lot of fishing with monofilament and I was fishing with 80 pound monofilament. And I was not liking it at all. Because number one, mono stretches a little bit more than fluorocarbon, and 80 pound is a little bit difficult to tie knots. At that time, I got a little bit better at it, but really, an 80 pound fluoro knot, I do improve clench knots when I'm fishing with fluorocarbon or mono. Not with braid, I do polymer knots with braid, but so what I'll do is I'll just do three wraps, and on the fourth one, I just feed it through and I just tie one right now. Why not? So what I do is so this is my 80 pound Blue Label Seaguar. I actually posted a thing on my story at Striped Bass Hunt. I asked people, is this too heavy? And really it's a 50-50 split is what I saw. 50% of people said that it was too heavy and 50% of people said it wasn't. So, and I think it really depends on where you're fishing, whether it's too heavy or not. So what I do is when I'm tying my polymer knot, and I have a video on my YouTube channel, which is also Striped Bass Hunt. If you're not watching this, if you're listening to this on the podcast, on one of the many podcasting apps that this goes to, but, I have a YouTube channel that I also post these podcasts with the video of the podcast, and, I also have something I call a quick tip, and I have both knots that I use from like monofilament and fluorocarbon and that I use for braid, so which are two different knots. So really what I do is I take my line, I wrap it three times, and then I feed it through on the fourth wrap around, and then back through, and then it's important when you're fishing, especially with, or when you're tying knots, especially with heavy line, that you wet the line with like your spit, or if you're in the water, you can, if your hands are wet or whatever, as long as it's wet, the knot won't burn and it will also tighten easier. So I wet the line and then I just pull and I pull on both sides and then I'll bite the line. It's probably not good for my teeth, but I bite the tag end and I pull with the tag end and then I pull again. And that is a perfect knot. Hopefully you guys will be able to see this on the video podcast. I'm just showing it to the camera. That's a pretty much perfect knot right there. I don't know if you can tell, but it's like a perfect knot. And it's only three wraps, but I guarantee you that that will not slip at all. That definitely will not slip. And if you are concerned about it slipping, cut a little bit longer tag end and then use a lighter and mushroom the tip of the tag. And what will happen is it will just make a little bit fatter end, which will make it more difficult for it to slide through the, I guess, the knot, so for the knot to slip. So I'm just going to cut this. And the other good thing about fishing with fishing with fluorocarbon is more expensive, unfortunately, but it is much, it's harder to see. It's much clearer in the water, and at night it's pretty much invisible, especially even if it's 80 pound test, it's pretty much invisible to the fish. Not that I think fish are line shy at all, and I fished with straight braid before. I actually caught my biggest fish ever with straight braid because I broke off and the fishing was insane, and so I just straight tied on a new like leader with my braided line, and they'll eat it. And also, I mean, look at these lips on these plugs. They're metal. This, no fish has a lip that's metal. So, like, say what you will about, like, fish being line shy. I just don't think it happens unless maybe you're in an estuary and it gives you confidence to use lighter line. But again, I have a podcast where I talk about why you shouldn't be so focused on things that give you confidence, because confidence always kills you. And so does like the indecisiveness when fishing. It's best to just stick with something and fish it. Although you do want to experiment when you need to. So I fish with 80-pound fluorocarbons when I'm in heavy, heavy structure. And that meaning if I'm fishing in a boulder field with super sharp granite rocks and barnacles and mussels and everything that easily, like when braided line's super tight and a fish runs across it, it snaps really quickly. But when you have this Blue Label Seaguar, which is the line that I fish with, it's more abrasion resistant than other fluorocarbons. And I think that it just has that extra protection against the fish and really against the rocks that the fish will take you into. Because if you think about it, a big fish is going to try to swim down into cover because it's getting pulled out of its, like, it feels you trying to pull it out of, like, cover, and it feels safe being deep in structure. So it's not necessarily that it knows that if I go into this structure, I can break this line, because it has no concept of that. Really, what it knows is I feel safer when I'm deep within these rocks and I'm just weaving in and out of these rocks, because it's going to be much more difficult for a predator to get me when I'm weaving in and out of these rocks than it is if I'm just swimming straight across the surface of the water. So when I'm using line, I want to use line that's super heavy. This gets me into my next thing. Really, I use, at minimum, I use 50 fluorocarbon. But I only use 50 fluorocarbon if I'm fishing in off of a sandy beach, or if I'm fishing in an estuary, or off of like a flat somewhere. I mean, I rarely use 50. And if I can get away with it, I'm going to be throwing 60. But I will also throw 60 to 70 in cover as well, in like deep structure. Just the reason I throw 80 pound like fluorocarbon is just matching my 80 pound Max Quattro Power Pro line that I have on my 275 VSX stall. So the reason that I use such heavy gear is because these fish are extraordinarily good at getting down into that structure really quick. With two swipes of their tail, they can get you, you know, they can get you probably 80 yards, not really, but they can get like at least 10 yards of line out with like two big swipes of a big fish's tail. I mean, it's extraordinary how far, like I said, like 80 yards, but I was thinking ahead, like when a big fish takes a run and it's going like as far as it can, I've had them go 80 yards. That's why I said 80, because that just popped into my head. Because when you are fighting this fish, it takes off and it will take off and it will pull 80 yards of line if you don't have your drag locked. And I mean locked. I never fish with light drag, because when you do, it really, what happens is the bass will take you right into the rocks and it will snap you off instantly. That being said, when I was talking about the line being when I was talking about the braid getting into the rocks, when the braid is super tight, it's so much easier to cut. So, for instance, these are both set up. They're not actually set up for eeling, but I've my two rods that I really do my damage with here. And so I have my line. I would like to show this. Right here. Let's just pull out some line. Yeah. Need some more line. Okay. So, if you can imagine this. So, when braid, so this is 80-pound braided line right here. So when the braid is tight, so this is taut line, you can actually cut you can, ooh, that was an awful noise. When the braid is tight, you can cut it. So if I, this is also 80 pound line, so this is extra hard to cut, but I'm just trying to put some tension on this line so I can cut off the leader that I have on here. Come on. So when you, this is why also why I'm using 80 pound leader, because with anything less than that, if it's tight, it's going to be easy to cut. So I'm fishing with my 80 pound leader. When it's super taut, like super taut, I can cut the line very easily. When it's not super taut, so say my line was a little bit looser, it's going to be way, way, way more difficult to cut. So if the line's looser and I try to cut it, it's not even making the line nicked or anything. Like, it's not fraying the line at all. Like, that's still pretty much 100%, like 100% strength. But if it's super taut, when your drag is super tight and it goes across that rock, it's going to cut it every single time. So when you're fighting a really big fish and you feel your braid go into a rock, immediately loosen up your drag. Not so you have no pressure on the fish, but so you have still enough pressure to just to bend the tip of your rod down. So the fish, when it shakes its head, can't shake your hook, but so that you have enough pressure, or not enough pressure on it, that when the fish is in the rocks and it's rubbing up against the rocks, it's not going to fray your line and snap it under hard pressure. Where when you have a lot of pressure on the line, pulling out a little knife now, and what happens is you have a lot of pressure on the line and you go across a rock and it just cuts like that. This is just like a crappy little pocket knife, and it just sliced that like butter. So that shows you that using that heavier line, it's going to be a lot easier for it to cut. I'm actually just gonna reel this in and put a rubber band around the reel here so that I can use this rod for a demonstration here. You see this on any other podcasts? I'm by myself and I can still do a demonstration. So for this scenario, we need to not break my rod. Okay, here we go. Let's just get this down here. It's going to be very interesting here. So this is, we're going to get into some rods and reels right now. Let's get into some rods and reels. So probably the rod, and I posted, again, this is another post I did on my Instagram the other day. The rod that did the most damage for me last season was a GSB Skinner rod. And I had so many questions about, like, this rod and people saying, like, oh, did I buy this rod because of John Skinner and his videos and everything? Or do I even know who John Skinner is and everything like that? So the reason I bought this rod in particular is it's super, like, it's the fishing that I do, this rod was built for. Like, fishing for bass that are in, that not necessarily you want to have a huge, heavy rod for, but you can still throw eels and it still has a backbone to pull the fish out of rocks. And it matched perfectly with my 200 VSX Van Staal. The thing is, this is, like, in my opinion, one of the best weights for, like, fishing medium-sized eels. So I'm talking about eels that are between 10 to maybe 18 inches. That's, like, and even less. I mean, I guess you could fish like a 5-inch, like, shoelace eel, like super small eel, all the way up to like a 18 inch eel. That's like what I would fish on this setup. And the reason for that being, and I was going to go into this, is when you're fishing for striped bass with eels, you want it to be able to grab the end of your line and the top of your rod to take in the flex of the fish, or taking the eel, when the bass is taking in the eel, sorry, when the bass is taking in the eel, the rod will be able to absorb that very gently. So if I'm just going to take this leader off here. So let's see if I can do this by myself here. Let's put this over here. Okay. So I'm a bass, and this will be much easier to see if you're watching the podcast. So I'm a bass, and this is my eel right here. I grab the eel. I'm pulling, and the rod is flexing, and it's actually going down, but the rod in theory will be flexing, and I'm not really feeling it. But then I still have a bend on my rod, and I can still take the eel without really feeling this rod. Where if I have, hold on. If I have an ODM Jigstar rod and I'm in bass trying to take this eel, I can feel this immediately. I can feel the pressure of this rod when I flex it. This is only the top half, but there's no give to this. Like, I can immediately feel the flex of the rod if I'm a bass trying to take the eel, where in this scenario, I don't really feel it, but then I get the pressure. So another rod that I use I'm going to be using next season, got it at the end of this season, but another rod that I'm super excited to eel with, and I talked about, is the Century Stealth Rod. So I got the Century Stealth Rod, and I'm going to show you basically the same thing here. Now I'm standing up, trying to get this all sorted here. Okay, so I have my Century Stealth, which is a longer rod. I think it's a 10'6" rod, so it's a little bit longer. So it's gonna be a little bit more difficult for me to deal with. But the good part about this rod is it is super, super flexible. So I have it on this cushion here. If I'm a bass and I'm taking an eel, this is gonna be tough. If I'm a bass and I'm gonna be taking an eel here, this rod has a super flexible, this is probably not the best way to show this, has an incredibly flexible tip to it. So way, way more than the other rod. It's kind of hard to see here, I guess, because I'm not really able to show this, but the tip of this rod is way, way more flexible and so much like easier to fish with, because it's also a much longer rod. So what happens is when the fish takes it, it can absorb so much more over a longer distance of the rod. I don't know enough about rods to tell you the specifics of exactly what power of rod this is. I just don't know enough. And hopefully as these podcasts go on, I can get people on this podcast that can tell you in much better detail and with much, much better examples of why different rods act certain ways when you're casting them and hooking into fish and fighting fish. But all I can tell you is when I'm fishing, I want to have a rod that has a soft tip to it. That helps me so much. So when I'm fishing, I'm reeling in, standing up again, I'm getting into this podcast. and I'm standing up and I'm reeling in my giant fish here. I have the rod at a high angle. So I'm reeling and I have the rod at a high angle. What I do is I brace the rod just against the inside of my thigh when I fight fish. And so I'm reeling and I feel the fish. What happens is I feel these taps on the top of my rod. These are hard taps, like really, like sometimes they're really like aggressive. The bass are like hitting the eel super hard, like knocking the rod out of my hand type strength. And as soon as I feel that whack of the fish, I'm gonna drop my rod just a little bit And then now, because I don't have like J hooks, I'm now going to be reeling up with the fish. So it's going to be more subtle. It's going to be a quick reel up. So what that's going to hopefully do is pull that eel from halfway into its stomach out and have the hook just get it right in the corner of the mouth. So that reeling is going to set the hook in position for then me to engage into the fish, and the rod, it being a softer rod, will be able to set up perfectly where the hook gets lodged into the, hopefully right into the corner of the bass's mouth, and I can fight the fish with a secured hook. Now, this is all in theory because I've never fished with a circle hook with eels. So maybe I'm gonna have to pause longer, maybe I'm not. So I just have to work a lot of different things out here. But that is very important when it comes to fishing with your rod. You wanna have a rod that is softer. Now the other thing, and the reason why I love Van Stahl's is, and people will be not necessarily, you know, like this is just one reason why they're great, I guess, is the amount of line that the reel picks up per crank of the handle is not as much as like a Daiwa Dogfight or a Shimano Stella or a anything else. Like all those other reels have so much more. I think the Dogfight is like 4 feet per crank, and this is like maybe two or three, I don't know. But so what that is the line per turn of the handle, there's going to be, so I guess I can show this here on the podcast. So if the handle, if we start with the handle at the top, by the time the handle gets all the way around to the top, the line roller will have picked up 2 feet of line or whatever. I don't exactly know. I get them all mixed up. So I'm not really going to tell you because I have two Van Stahl's and they're both, I got the 200 and the 275. So, and the reason I got the 275 is it holds, number one, it holds bigger, more line, heavier line. And it picks up a little bit more line. And I think the drag is different. Not entirely sure, but I was just testing it both with my hands, like tightening, locking the drag down with both the 275 and the 200. And the 275 was, in my personal opinion, a little bit more difficult to pull out. So I think that that's a little bit heavier. Again, I couldn't for the life of me figure out the actual drag on either of the Van Stahl's, like how much drag they give. And I looked pretty like hard to find it. So if any of you know, comment below the exact amount of like pounds of drag you get with the 200, 250 and 275 Van Stahl VSX. Cause I'm legitimately curious about this because, having fished the Van Stahl's pretty much exclusively, I locked my drag down, would love to know exactly how much. I guess I could figure it out, but I'm too lazy to go into, get some sort of a like scale and pull and see. You know what? I'll do that one podcast or before a podcast, I'll go figure out the exact amount of drag that the Van Stahl 200 and the Van Stahl 275 have, and I will report back in the next podcast. That will be my mission, my homework, I guess, for the next podcast. But the reels have not as much line pickup, so you don't have to be reeling super, like creeping it. You can actually reel it at somewhat of a steady pace, and the eel will slowly move across the rock. So really what you want to do is reel it slow enough that the eel is a few feet under the surface, but fast enough that the eel is not in getting you tangled and stuck into a rock or into some obstruction under the water. And that is very important because I've so many times I'll have these eels and I'll be reeling them and they're super lively and they get me plugged right into a rock and you have to like break off and you lose like yards of line and you lose your whole setup and you have to retie. It sucks. It's the pain in the ass. And the other thing eels do, so I'm going to talk about keeping eels alive and everything because this is something that I've learned. So when you buy eel, American eels, so this is the deal about American eel. American eels, I actually have a book I can go grab and pull it. You know what? Let's take 2 seconds because this is just right over here. 2 seconds, pause. I'm grabbing a book where I can tell you some interesting facts about the American eel. Okay, we're back. The American eel. Okay, let's find this in this book. I'm not exactly sure where this is. Hold on. We're looking at the Peterson's Field Guide of Freshwater Freshwater Fish. And if you didn't know, the American eel, which is the eel that, here we go, it's right at the beginning of this book. American eel, which is, okay, hold up. American eel, snake-like body, and has snake-like head, long dorsal fin, continuous with the caudal and the anal fins. So this is very interesting. Has no pelvic fins, but also can, so get this, it can grow to be 60 inches. That is enormous. 60 inches is huge. 146. This is some of the things that we get on, or what was that, 446? What are we at? Yeah, 146. Hold up. Oh. 145, 148, 146. American eel. Yeah, it can grow to be 60 centimeters range. So get this. Okay. Catadromous species that spawns in the Atlantic Ocean and ascends into streams. So pretty much what that means is the what they do is they spawn in the ocean, right? And in the Atlantic Ocean, and then ascends into streams. Yeah, so that's what the fish does, is it, the eel goes, it lives in, I've caught them in ponds with nets when you, like, in science class, if you ever go to, like, a vernal pond or, like, a pond system and you're, like, scraping around in the muck in the ponds, you'll find the American eels. They're not that common, but you'll find them, and they'll be pretty big eels. They're not huge generally when you're finding them, but they can be pretty large, and you'll find them in ponds and in up estuaries. They spawn like striped bass. They spawn in like fresh water, or they spawn in salt water like rivers and stuff. And so one of the big reasons why people say they are the striped bass love eating them is because they spawn in the same areas as the striped bass do. So they believe that the eels will actually eat the eggs of the striped bass, and the striped bass are kind of programmed to kill the eels and eat them because they are a predator of their spawn. So that's pretty interesting. Habitat, usually in permanent streams with continuous flow, hides during daylight in undercut banks and deep pools near logs and boulders. So if you're ever trying to catch your own eels, which I've been trying to do for years because eels are way too expensive at stores, that's I guess where they live and how to catch them. So I'm gonna try very hard next season to catch my own eels, and I'll keep you guys posted on how that goes. So that's a little facts about the eel, because eels are pretty interesting in among themselves. I'm also pretty sure that they're pretty rare at this point. I think people are eating them, and they're not like super common. So I think that they're like eel farms, and then or they catch them in Maine or something like that. I don't know. There's some. I don't want to get into stuff that I don't really understand. But that's my little spiel about the eel itself. I kind of lost my train of thought exactly what I was gonna talk about as far as the line and stuff. So we have 50-pound. I fish with like two types of line on this reel. I have 50-pound super slick just for casting distance, because I also love this for like a smaller topwater plugs, like little Pumbaa pencils or and like big eyes. The little big eyes are great on this plug. So that's why I really like using 50-pound on this with this little bit smaller Van Stahl. So if I am fishing in estuaries and stuff and off of sandy beaches, I'll go with this. Although, I mean, it held up in the surf and in the rocks, but I caught a good amount of huge, like 40-pound bass. And I caught so many big 40-pound bass, I was like, I can't be having these fish take off and pull 80 yards of line on me in some current. I need to be able to stop them, because each foot of line that they pull out, you are so screwed. Because, I mean, you get 80 yards, that's so far. That is so far. And what happens is that each yard they go is more surface area for them to get into into like boulders, and it is much more difficult to stop the fish when you get them into the boulder fields, and they're not I mean, that's bad. It's really bad. You don't want them to get into the rocks, because then obviously it makes it, you damage your line, you snap your line. It also makes the fight way more tricky, and it can also make the fight a lot longer. I mean, I fought one fish where they got me right because I hooked up right next to a boulder. As soon as it dropped in the water, it was hooked up, and it got me right behind this boulder. I probably fought it for 15 minutes behind this boulder, just with super light drag, just trying to get it out from this rock. I finally did and landed it. It was like a 35, 36 inch bass, but it got me right behind the rock. So it was a pretty difficult scenario to trying to land that fish. And it was like, it was hard. And I didn't like it because it was way too long for that fish to, like, I don't like fighting fish very long. So if I can spend a little extra money and get a little bit bigger of a reel and be able to fight a fish harder and faster, I think that that's a lot better for the fish, to be much fresher going into, the water after the fight. So we've gone over line, we've gone over rods. Let's go over, I guess, how to time a day that I fish eels. And I talked a little bit about this, but I like fishing eels at night. And the reason I like fishing eels at night is because I have always done the best at fishing for large striped bass at night. And eels have always produced large striped bass for me. So I'm going to fish at night. And I really like sunset through the first probably 5 hours of dark. So I fish probably for like 5 hours from right at sunset through probably 1-2 in the morning. And then I like sunrise again. But pretty much after 2 in the morning, it's a wash, because it's not really going to change. If the conditions are good, they're going to be great for the rest of until probably 3, because that's when it starts getting bright again. And then once it starts getting brighter again, right around 3, that's a good time to start as well. Like, you start at like 1 or 2 and you fish until like 7 and that in the morning. And that's great because you get that whole spectrum of the light just starting to creep in. And sometimes that can trigger a bite, and that can be really fun too. And I've caught a lot of my biggest fish just right at sunset. A lot of those 40 pounders that I got this season were right at sunset. And I can guarantee you, I got this comment I had this comment the other day on a post, and it was like, nice. It said not to like argue with like people on the internet, because this is just at this point, like, why? But it said, none of those are all nice fish, but none of them are 40 pounds. And I'm 6'3", and I'm holding up one of these fish, and it's going from my feet to halfway up my chest to like right here. So I'm not going to say anything, but that was, I mean, that's a big fish. That was 49 inches. And if you're telling me a 49-inch bass is not even 40 pounds, then I don't even know what to say to you anymore. But, you know, when you get a fish that big, that's getting closer to 50 than it is 40. Even in, to this day, I mean, we didn't get a full perfect weight on that. It was super, like, again, I talked about in the other podcast, I was looking at this video again because it drove me crazy because I actually never got to see how much this fish weighed. When I held it up on the boga, the thing was around the other side and it was so heavy that I was holding it up with two hands and I couldn't adjust the scale. So I never got to see how heavy it was. But when we looked back at the video, it was 40 or 50 pounds. It was right in between it. And he said 40. And I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. Because the camera guy that I was fishing with actually doesn't fish. So he was just there to take video. And he doesn't really know how to read the boga. But who knows? So we're calling that a mid 40 pounder. 40 to mid 40 pounder. And it was 49 inches. I like got the length of it. It was a beautiful, beautiful fish. It was so, it just was thick across the head and it was big. It was super big. And I took some quick photos. I held it up, took some really quick, I landed this fish and there's a picture of me walking it through the water and I slide it up onto a seaweed bank just out of a tide pool. And there's a picture of me like holding it, which is a great picture. I have it, I think, if you haven't seen it yet, it's a great picture. I have my hand on a rock and one hand on a boga grip with this huge long fish and its tail like right next to the camera. And you get to see how long and wide the tail of the bass is. And I did that and I just held it up for these few pictures. And these are some, I couldn't even hold that fish out. It was so heavy. I had to like brace it on my knee. It was so heavy. I mean, and I've caught some heavy fish. That was definitely my biggest bass of the year. And it was a big fish. And it pulled a lot of line. And we were fortunate to have somebody there taking pictures and ready to take pictures. Because for me, the most important thing is the health of the fish. So when I'm holding up this fish, I don't really care. But if I can get a blurry picture out of it, I'm happy. But the fact that he was on the ball and we could get a handful of pictures and some video of me weighing it was really awesome. And we got it probably back in the water in under 2 minutes. And it was in a tide pool when we weren't taking pictures with water getting washed in with waves. So I feel like I handled that fish well. And I was able to release that fish and it kicked off in maybe 3 seconds of it being placed back into the water. And there's a picture, and I've never really posted this picture because he got the picture of me right after I hit the tail of the fish was swimming away. So I just like hit the tail of the fish and it just soaked me with water. And I'm like stepping back and there's like a wave of water coming at my face because that fish doused me after it kicked off. It was perfectly fine. And you cannot tell me that that fish died because it was hooked right in the top of its mouth. And I landed it under 2 minutes. It was probably right around 2 minutes, just a bit under, but it was a huge fish and it was in current and huge surf and it fought really hard, but I landed it pretty quick. But now with this bigger reel, I'm hoping to land some fish much quicker, which should be good. So anyway, I hope you guys enjoyed this podcast and I hope it cleared up a little bit about eeling, even though a little bit of this would have been repeat. I hope that this cleared up a little bit. I guess I want to talk a little bit more about the moon. I've done it so much. New moon is fantastic for eeling. Full moon is fantastic for eeling. Fish at night, fish between, you know, the certain hours, you know, right at sunset, right at sunrise. And then also 3 days before and 3 days after the moon's like either moon phase are the best fishing you'll have the entire month. So that's like when the fish are going to be the most aggressive, the most actively feeding. So that's when I would buy some eels. I'd actually buy some eels. If you plan it out, it really gives you a good amount of time. It gives you a week where you should have a shot at catching like if you want to catch a trophy, you want to catch your 50 pound bass, it should give you a week to dial in. Okay, I'm in this spot. I need this wind. So hopefully within that week, and you have multiple weeks to hit it, but hopefully within multiple weeks of it being a new or a full moon, you can get the perfect wind at least once. And in that day where you get that perfect wind, you can get that bite where it's just gong show action. Every cast, you're catching bass that are 25 to 30 pounds. So, and hopefully, if you're lucky, you can catch your 50-pounder. So thank you guys for listening to this podcast. Hope you guys enjoyed this podcast. But before I go, the next podcast, or within the next few podcasts, I'm going to have my first real guest, which will be Joe from Pumbaa Plugs. And he creates the plugs and the plugs that all the pretty much all the only plugs that I throw. And he's going to talk about these plugs because they're actually incredibly unique, being one of the, or the, probably the most, and if not the most, environmentally friendly plugs, down to, you know, the paint, the epoxy, the hooks, and everything that goes into it. He's found the most environmentally friendly stuff to build them with. He has a very interesting, like, story about why he started fishing, and like who he's met fishing, and his whole everything is super cool and super awesome. So I hope to sit down for a little bit with him and talk about some awesome topics, and it will be super awesome to have the first guest onto the podcast, and it would be pretty cool to hopefully have that be a start of every once in a while we can get on, or as much as often as I can. I'm going to be trying to get on guests so I don't have to, so you guys don't have to listen to just me, talking for an hour by myself. So hopefully you guys enjoyed this podcast, and I'll see you next time.